Okay, so up until this point, Paul's been making his way to Jerusalem, and he's now there. We've emphasized as recently as Sunday, in our Sunday class, we emphasized a couple of key themes. One being the value of Christ-centered friendships. We talked about that a lot. And I know that's something that the people in this room treasure. And I hope that we always do. That is so essential for us as believers today in any age. And then we also considered, of course, as always, the cost of discipleship. Paul has known for some time in our narrative that he would be going to Jerusalem. And we'd suffer many things. Of course, others knew that through the Spirit. But then we kind of saw, you know, how fickle, well, fickle's not the right word, how unreliable human emotions can be in guiding us, right? Everybody had the same information about what was going to happen to Paul, but some were reaching the wrong conclusion, because it wasn't God's will for Paul to stay away from Jerusalem. So that's an important reminder for us as well. So tonight we're going to look, now Paul's in Jerusalem, and in this text, this is chapter 21, beginning with verse 37, all the way through chapter 22 through chapter 23, verse 11. It wasn't completely arbitrary where I picked that, but I found a decent breaking point where the narrative continues next week. Of course, Paul's eventually going to go to Rome. That's what Paul has been purposing in the Spirit, that he would go to Macedonia and Achaia, and then to Jerusalem, and then after that, he's saying to himself, I must also see Rome. Well, in this text, Jesus is going to affirm, indeed, that is where he's going to go. And so, again, Jesus is orchestrating everything so that that's where we see how the Lord is using everything that happens and the people, either primary characters or incidental players in the drama. Jesus is using them and their influence, such as it may be, to get Paul to Rome. That's eventually where he's going to go. But for now, he's captive in Jerusalem. So we're going to track tonight, I guess to kind of organize this, just track some of the interactions that take place between Paul and various people. Give me some of the persons or groups of persons that Paul interacts with, either personally or through oratory, speaking to them in mass.
Luke.
Well, okay, so they're all of his traveling companions. No conversations here per se amongst all of those, but they're somewhere here in all of this. Sorry?
You want to talk about the man who arrested?
Well, yeah, there are the Romans in all of this. We're going to talk about one individual in particular. And then, of course, you've got several Jews involved. We think of two groups in particular, and who are those two groups?
Sadducees and Pharisees.
Okay, the Sadducees and Pharisees. That'd be one way to answer that, certainly. There was a Jewish crowd, right, at one point. And then later, so he speaks to them, goes well for a time, until he uses a buzzword that sets them off. And then later he's going to have occasion to speak to another group of Jews. They're known as what? Yeah, council. Council. Sanhedrin. How do you say that? I never know how to say these names. Sanhedrin Council, okay? So I've kind of organized our thoughts around that, and I'm curious to see what you made of some of this. Paul's going to make a couple of defenses here, and I want us to think about what the Lord is doing in all of this through Paul. Again, this is a change in Acts. Paul's been on the move, and now he's immobile, okay, largely. And yet the Lord is still using Paul. People are brought, you know, he's granted occasion to speak before people. He's not openly traveling. The gospel's still being proclaimed is just a different way of doing things than Paul's been used to. But he's ever relying on Christ. Okay, so before we get to some of those interactions, we've been talking about some of the parallels between Paul's going to Jerusalem, right? And Jesus's, you know, setting his face to go to Jerusalem. Of course, now Paul's in the city. Did you think of that at all? Did you notice any other parallels while he's here in the city and giving his defense? I mean, we could think of some dissimilarities, but in the vein of similarities between Paul here in Jerusalem, Jesus in Jerusalem. It's just a question.
I could attempt, but he's... So you're saying just to Jerusalem, obviously Jesus did the same.
Right.
For the particular, you know, Pentecost and Passover, that has for Jesus. But,
right.
But then, so even here, Paul has a good welcome among those other further brethren, sort of this, but then it turns bad where Jews start to stir it up and go to the dragon before the high priest.
Okay.
So, of course, they eventually go some trials and makes it to glory the Roman.
Yeah,
it's falsely accused, even they eventually bring
right.
false accusations against him and everything too. What he was doing was totally false. Of course, the contrast is Paul does make a defense, but Jesus never really does.
Well, that's one of the dissimilarities, right? Jesus largely doesn't say anything. Paul is doing a lot of speaking. But to that point about the head Roman in charge, as it were, Pilate's equivalent is not part of this text. But who would the head Roman in charge be for all intents and purposes, insofar as what we're the arena of action that we're looking at? Who is the head Roman in charge? We don't learn his name in this section. We actually learn it in chapter 23. But his function, his military rank is mentioned. What? Well, there is a centurion, not who I'm thinking of, but there is a centurion here.
Felix is the counselor.
The procurator or
the... Procurator of the area.
Yeah, still not who I'm thinking of.
Tribune.
Yeah, the Tribune, not the newspaper. Is a Tribune or Tribune? I'm not an expert on Roman military terms. I will probably end up using both pronunciations. You almost don't think of him, right? He's almost an incidental character here. I do want us to think about him in a little bit, but he's essentially the guy in charge, right? I mean, he has a key hand in essentially allowing Paul to speak. The first defense that he gives, he grants Paul permission. The second one, the Tribune sets up himself because he's trying to get to the bottom of things. Of course, what would his primary concern be in all this?
Peace in the city.
He gets involved in chapter 21 when he hears that Jerusalem's in confusion. Some Jews are beating Paul, and so he brings in his guys and puts a stop to it. But then begins a series of conversations between Paul and this Tribune that I find fascinating. And we'll get to that in a second. But what he's going to conclude later on in chapter 23 is essentially what Pilate concludes, is he's done nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. Now I'm thinking, oh, that rings familiar. That rings familiar. And yet he's going to suffer. So Paul's learning some more about his Lord, isn't he? About the way he suffered innocently. Jesus told one of the Ananiases early on, realize there are at least three Ananiases in Acts. Chapter 5, the one that died. There's chapter 9, and here in chapter 22, the disciple in Damascus. And then there was the high priest, who is no good, scoundrel. But he told the chapter 9 Ananias, I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. Okay, any other observations about just this text in general? Things that struck you before we get into our talking points? Is this a section of Acts that you've studied as much? I've got to say no. It's not for me. It hasn't been. I wonder why that is. Why do you think? I mean, it's Bible study. Is it because there's not as much movement?
Because we studied 13 weeks and we're running out of time at the end.
Or energy. Yeah. We're dealing with finite resources. Yeah, we study it for a time, and by the time we get to chapter 20, that great speech to the Ephesian elders, and then we're, okay, and we know he's going to end up in Rome, so that's, we just kind of, that's what chapters 21 through 28 are about, him going to Rome. Well, I think there's a lot more there. It's interesting Luke devotes this much space. And I don't pretend to have all of the answers to why, but 8 chapters of imprisonments and travels, eventually on boats and all the troubles that go with it, and interesting interactions with people, and a snake bites him at some point. Not really like, you know, the first 20 chapters at all. All right, so let's gear up here and let's see what we can find together, okay? Let's think about this tribune for just a second. I don't want to, obviously we never want to make more of the text than is written, right? Never want to do that. We don't want to try to find, so hard to find lessons that aren't there. Just because we're, you know, whatever, trying to be clever, you know. But I was struck by Paul's interactions with this Roman tribune. Follow me on this and forgive me while I get my readers out. I'm going to chapter 21. I want you to look at this with me. And I'm going to move this hymnal. Not sure how it ended up there. Probably kids playing church afterwards. Okay, chapter 21. I will find this in a second. Okay, 31. That's what we were talking about before. The Jews are seeking to kill him. This is after... Now remember what Paul did? James asked him to do? We got 4 men who are under a vow. And I didn't, you know, sometimes, you know, you forget details from a previous study. I want you to remember, there's a little bit of a detail here we may forget. That kind of leads to, I think, one of the tribune's questions. Okay, so there are 4 men, and what? Remember what James said to do, basically? Pay their expenses, because they've got, you know, purify yourself along with them, pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. So I presume that means, you know, Paul went through that whole process with them. So, think about that. Jerusalem's in confusion. The Jews are beating up this guy, right? They were beating him, right? Well, they dragged him out of the temple. Yeah, end of 32, beating Paul. The tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with 2 chains. And we talked about how that could be a fulfillment of what Agabus said. Was it Agabus? The one that took Paul's belt and said, in this manner, he'll be bound. Now, what does he look like? Yeah. That's a weird question. Does he look like a Jew necessarily? I mean, if you're a Roman and you expect, okay, yeah, I've got a Jew here, how would you know? Skin color, yeah, but I mean, not many Jews going around with that are shaven, right? Let the hair grow out. It's interesting because he clearly does not understand he's a Jew at first. So, what does the tribune want to know? Verse 33. He inquired who he was and what he had done. I'm just going to think out loud about this with you. You know, we might have thought, well, James's suggestion backfired, right? Because it got Paul arrested. Well, number one, he was going to be arrested anyway. The Spirit had already made that clear. Second of all, the purpose for Paul doing all of that at the request of James and the others was for the sake of the Jewish brethren. So on that count, mission accomplished. But his appearance, I believe, creates some curiosity that the Lord is going to leverage over the course of time in its own way to create opportunities for Paul to do more speaking. So he wants to know who he is and what he had done. Now, was he quickly able to learn that? No, because it was a mad scene, right? The city was in confusion. In fact, Luke repeats in verse 34, he could not learn the facts because of the uproar. That's a statement you could underline and apply in a lot of situations. People seldom learn things in times when the emotions are, when emotions are ginned up, when emotions are high, ears are usually closed, nobody's thinking clearly. That's just not a great environment for learning anything. So this man wisely said, okay, I've got to get more control of this situation. So I mean, his job, whoever made the point, is to keep the peace. And I think that's what his primary concern is the whole time. But it's interesting how this drags out. He could not learn the facts because of the uproar. Okay, so he brings him into the barracks. In fact, they have to carry him out of there. Well, verse 37, how does Paul leverage this situation? Look at 37, 38, 30. What's Paul thinking? Wow, great escape. He might have been, but I think we can infer what he has on his mind. What?
Opportunity.
How can I find a way? Now, if you'd been arrested, you get in the scene. What are the soldiers if they had to carry me out? But anyway, I mean, they're carrying you out. So, I mean, and all the time he's thinking gospel. Would you have been thinking that? Would I have been thinking that? Just a question. You see what's happening? You know, Paul, down to his spiritual DNA, his wiring, was gospel, kingdom, setbacks, gospel, kingdom. And so what does he have the temerity to ask this? If I were this tribune, I would be more than a little annoyed. I mean, I don't know how he came to have this post. But I would consider this the short end of the stick. It could be a lot of trouble trying to keep this city at times that kind of had a history of rebellion, violence, and so forth. I think that's fair to say. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. Anyway, I don't know what mental state this guy was in, but Paul has the boldness to say what? Well, no, he doesn't say that. We'll get to that. He says, may I say something to you? Now, we can infer that Paul said that in Greek because the tribune kind of does a double take. You see what's happening? He's really intrigued by this. Increasingly intrigued. We're not told this, but if you're the tribune, and that's the question Paul asks you, I mean, I don't know, maybe that wouldn't be an off-the-wall question. Why does that strike the tribune as curious? We learned something, I mean, he's wondering about who this guy is. And we've already talked about his appearance, so he's I think it's his appearance driving this thought process. I would be hard pressed to know what else it would be. Again, I'm not trying to make too much of this, but put yourself in this scene. The tribune is wanting to know who he is and what he had done. He wants to get to the bottom of this, and Paul starts talking to him in Greek, which completely blew him away. Because in his mind, I mean, he reveals what he had been thinking. What was he wondering about Paul? Is he this Egyptian guy that he's talking about that incited some rebellion? Well, Paul's going to explain as he's talking to him in Greek. He thinks he's Egyptian. He's way off. He finds out, no, he's a Jew, which by appearance is atypical. And he learns something of him. He's actually from a well-known city. And so Paul gains favor with him through all of this. Okay? I want you to think about this theme of creating curiosity. Why are we spending so much time kind of straining at this? What is all of this going to lead to? And this is important. All these incidental details, you say, why are we talking about that? But where this is leading is super important. What's this going to open a door to? Paul is going to get to speak to the Jews, right? And he does it, I believe, by creating curiosity in this tribune. Just wants there to be peace. Is that too much to ask? Now, if Paul we could go and read about Paul's sufferings are well documented. The number of times he was beaten, the number of times he was shipwrecked. At some point, would you just be like, enough, I'm done. And just pout. How could have Paul reacted in this scene? Could have just railed about his life, right? This isn't what I signed up for. Well, actually it was, but
that's not the kind of person Paul was. I mean, you go back to chapter 21.
Yeah.
He was willing to be bound. He was willing to die right there.
That's exactly right.
So.
That's exactly right.
He's been through, he's been left dead.
Yeah.
All the things that's happened to him. I think to Paul, this was no big deal. It was an opportunity.
You know what I find curious, Larry? Paul doesn't raise this till later. Paul brings up an interesting little fact about himself later that scares this guy to death. And what is that? You know, you find it interesting. He could have, because he had just been bound here. Now, I mean, but what is Paul thinking? How can I talk to these people? We're kind of just left to wonder about some of that. I'm just bringing it out with your help to get us thinking about that. Because here's the takeaway. We've got to be thinking gospel, and we've got to be thinking kingdom. And how can I create curiosity? I'll tell you one of the ways it just creates curiosity without preaching a sermon about it is just when people respond to difficulty like unlike normal people do. Because most people in Paul's situation would not have reacted this way. Those are thoughts take that and think about that. Think on that this week. Anybody have any thoughts about that? Just throwing that out for your consideration. I don't make too much of this. But you go through here, Paul learns he speaks Greek, curiosity. Gives him permission to speak. Wasn't obliged to. In fact, you could argue, okay, does that turn out well? It does okay for a while. We'll get to that. But it's like, this man just continues to work with Paul. I find that fascinating. In our next section, he's going to work with Paul's nephew to protect his life. Paul is gaining influence with this man. He's connecting with this man. Now, the way I would like the story to finish is this guy ends up learning the gospel. I don't have any earthly idea whether he ends up hearing the gospel. He doesn't ask. I mean, but he is curious, who is this guy and why are the Jews so upset? Listen, could those questions eventually lead at some point to the cross? In fact, I would submit Paul does indirectly finally answer the guy's curiosity by how he speaks to the council. He finally hears one word that if he has any seeking heart at all, that seed is going to find free course. And I would love to know the rest of this guy's story. We just don't know. But he wouldn't be the first Roman official to come to the cross and say, truly, this was the Son of God. Just thoughts. Let's think now about the first group of Jews that he speaks to, the Jewish crowds. He asks for permission to speak to them. Okay? How does that go? Well, as we said, okay for a while. What would you say his speech accomplished here?
They heard the truth whether they liked it or not.
What kinds of things? Go ahead.
Sorry. What it might have accomplished
eventually. So I'm sure a lot of them had their minds made up about Paul. Paul's a bad guy. Paul's this, Paul's that. Well, did Paul get any chance to set the record straight on some of that for honest hearts who might have been in the crowd just kind of at the time just going along with it? What kinds of set the record straight sort of facts would have dispelled some of the false information out there about him? Okay.
The curiosity point almost continued on the start of this.
Okay.
That I'd like to bring up real quick. Because in verse 2,
mm-hmm.
he switches what language he speaks.
He does.
And it says that it quieted the crowd. So the
yes.
crowd was in confusion. They were beating they were beating Paul.
Yep.
And Paul, once again, I think creates curiosity here
yep.
to get the crowd back in tune to listen to him. for what he's getting ready to tell us.
Yep, that's right. That's an excellent point. Excellent point. He uses that as a device so he can get a listening audience so he can plant some seeds. That was a very smart move on Paul's part. And Paul's doing all of this. I mean, he's got the Lord with him. He's got the Spirit guiding him. This is masterful. So what sort of things does this crowd hear? Rapid fire, what are some of the things that he hears, or that a Jew in that audience would have heard about Paul? In the vein of setting the record straight, you know, I'm throwing this out for clarification. Phil, was it that some others have thought that maybe Luke wrote Acts as a defense of Paul?
Right.
Well, this would have been a prime text for that. Anyway. So what kinds of, you know, if Luke's right, what sort of defense is Paul making here? What kinds of things is he saying?
He persecuted Christians.
Okay. The accusation was, you don't respect your heritage. You brought a Gentile past the point where you're allowed to, which is preposterous. That was the original charge. So he, you know, so what did you say again? Okay, he kind of tells his story as basically, I am kind of like the last Jew in the world you would have thought would have started preaching Jesus. So what would be the point about making that case? I mean, you cite all of this information, and what would the conclusion to that? What's the point he's making to them? This is who I am. This is who I was. I'm proud of my heritage. So, fellow Jew, what is he calling on them to do, essentially?
He said, I was zealous toward God as you all are today.
He acknowledges their zeal. He commends their zeal for God, misplaced as it may be, misdirected. He's calling on them to, in essence, maybe you ought to consider the facts about Jesus of Nazareth. I did not seek him out. Quite the opposite, he sought me out. I was persecuting him. I was raised under Gamaliel. You want to talk zeal? It kind of sounds like that one passage where it's Hebrew, you know, Philippians 3. If I could boast, here it is.
Well, you made it a point who his teacher was.
Gamaliel.
That said, he was no average person.
That's exactly right. This is a... He's a Pharisee of Pharisees, the creme de la creme of people who are zealous for the law and for the temple and for all things that Moses has, you know, delivered to the people. Why do you think he cites Ananias? I mean, he's part of the story. Another trustworthy witness here. I mean, he's not a crazy guy. He's a guy a lot of people respect. Right? And eventually he's going to say in verse 17, I returned to Jerusalem. And what about the temple? What was Paul doing in the temple? We don't learn this in Acts 9, by the way. He was praying in the temple. He didn't dislike the temple. He didn't want to destroy the temple. He was proud of his heritage. He prayed in the temple. And he cites this vision. So, this would have been the kind of message that would have... It's, to me, one of the key questions is... Yeah, this guy is like the least likely sort of person to begin following Jesus. Maybe we ought to rethink all of this. Well, he plants seeds up until the point he says Gentiles, and of course, whoa, you know, they lose their stuff. And so he, Lysias comes back in, and he's brought into the barracks. Now, standard operating procedure kicks in. He's going to kind of speed this up a little bit. Okay, I got to get to the bottom of this. Let's flog the guy. And then, and only then, he says, oh, did I mention I'm a Roman citizen? So then, whoa, okay, change of approach. Okay, we're going to get the body. I'm going to get Paul here, and I'm going to command the council. Yeah, it was interesting. He said, I commanded the council. He commanded the council. He means business. And so, what happens with that? I mean, we just got a couple minutes here, maybe. But what do you think Paul accomplishes here?
He's rubbing it in their face again.
Rubbing it in their face?
Council just can't get rid of the teaching or nothing.
Yeah. Well, that's true. You think I'm going to just offer this thought. I think he exposes some hypocrisy. Starting with the high priest. Because he wasn't wrong. History, I mean, this guy was no good. In fact, in about 10 years' time, he would be killed by his own people. He was a whitewashed wall. Some have suggested that maybe Paul truly didn't know it was the high priest because of, you know, how some think Paul's eyesight was bad. It'd be only speculation. Just throw that out for your own study. You know, I mean, his the thing he chooses to say, he's quickly determining, okay, I'm not going to be able to plant very many seeds here. Right? He got the other crowd to listen to him for a while. He knows he's not going to get that kind of audience here. So he says the one thing that does get to the heart. I mean, for Lysias, this would have answered the question. And at the same time, exposes the hypocrisy of the Jews, because they can't even agree on this point. And yet they dare to put Paul on trial. And that's concerning the whole topic of the resurrection from the dead. On that point, the Sadducees were like, no, don't want to hear it. So think about those three things. In a tough situation, Paul created curiosity, he planted seeds, and in many ways, in his own, by living above board, it kind of exposes the wickedness of others by comparison. Because Paul is blameless. And so that in and of itself condemns the accuser, doesn't it? They stand condemned before God because this Roman tribune is going to eventually write a letter, and he rightly says, he's not done anything worthy of this kind of treatment. That's a condemnation on the accusers. So they end up with egg on their face. The gospel, the Lord, is glorified. Thoughts for your further study. So for Sunday, pick up in chapter 23, go all the way through the end of 24. So basically 23 and 24, we'll try and tackle that, God willing.